This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 223.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast, where it's all about helping you conquer the distance. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we interview Vibar Cregan-Reed, author of the fascinating new book, Footnotes, How Running Makes Us Human. And in the quick tip segment, Angie answers a listener question about staying healthy during marathon training. And of course, to get expert help in your training for whatever goal you're after, you can find out how to connect with us and our coaches and our awesome online community when you visit marathontrainingacademy.com.
So, Trevor, you've been doing a lot of traveling since we last recorded an episode. Tell us about going to Podcast Movement.
Yes, it's good to be back. Good to be behind the microphone here. Just got back from about a week-long trip. First, I went to Podcast Movement in Anaheim, California, which was a podcasting conference. Had over 2,000 podcasters from around the world. And so it was a lot of fun just to see what folks were doing and hear from industry experts about how podcasting is growing. Apparently, podcasting as a medium is still in its embryonic stage. The greatest growth is still ahead.
Wow, exciting.
And it's cool because we've been doing this for so long. A lot of folks that I'd met at the conference have only been doing it a year or so, maybe a couple of years.
Well, I was super jealous because you got to meet two of my favorite podcasters there. You sent me a picture, so that was neat.
That's right. I got to meet Gretchen Rubin and her sister Elizabeth Kraft. Gretchen, we've had on the show twice. And Gretchen and Elizabeth do the Happier podcast. And they have a huge audience. And it's really cool to meet her in person because we've only, you know, talked to her on the podcast before. Never met her in real life. So, and after the conference, I got on the plane and I flew to Colorado and I did the Breckenridge Spartan Sprint. I met a friend there, and we ran it together. So a sprint is around 4 miles. I think the Breckenridge Sprint was 4.7, and it's up at elevation, so over 10,000 feet of elevation, which I'm not used to. So I could definitely feel the effects. You know, I was huffing and puffing.
I bet. But did you notice that you'd improved on the obstacles this time?
I did, yeah. Since this was my second Spartan, I kind of knew what to expect. So I've been practicing my rope climb. So I didn't fail any of those obstacles. The only obstacle I failed this time was a spear throw. I still need to practice that somehow.
See a spear target in our backyard, huh?
I'm sure the kids would love to participate in that too.
Oh, I'm sure. But it doesn't seem like you were too sore from the event because you and your friend did a couple of hikes then.
Yeah, the event was not bad. I mean, it was only 4 miles. And the next day we decided we needed to collect a 14er. Because in Colorado, there's all these mountains that are, you know, 14,000 feet or higher. So we did a 14er called Quandary Peak, and my calves are so sore now, I mean, to this day from that.
It's brutal. But you got some gorgeous pictures up there.
Yeah, it's definitely an epic hike, and I saw a mountain goat. If you want to see any of the pictures, folks, you can follow us on Instagram at Marathon Academy, where I share some photos. And so now that I'm back, you're getting ready to go to run a marathon in Wyoming.
That's right. I get on the plane tomorrow morning and be flying to Jackson Hole, Wyoming to do the marathon on Saturday. So I'm excited about that. And speaking of races, we have the MTA virtual half in which registration is open for right now.
That's right. Man, this thing is getting huge. So excited to see the response. Thank you everyone who signed up for this race. Like Angie said, it's a virtual half. So 13.1 miles or 21.1 kilometers. And it's taking place in November. For more info, you can go to marathontrainingacademy.com/half. We've had husband and wives sign up who are going to run it together. Heard from several people who are going to do this as their first half marathon.
Wow.
So really honored to hear that. There's a mom in Oregon who's going to run it with her two daughters. So shout out to Cheryl, Kendall, and Nicoa. Excited to hear you guys are going to run together. We also heard from a friend of ours who's a Navy officer. His name is Daniel, and he'll be running it on a treadmill on board the USS Nimitz.
Excellent.
So,
and we also heard from Manny on Facebook. He says, when I quit smoking, I decided to start running. It was your podcast that took it to a whole new level. So I will have that medal to add to my collection.
Right on.
And of course, he's referring to the medal in which my head spins around.
That's right. Around and Around. You'll have to check it out. You can see, if you haven't seen the medal yet, it's over on our website. You can check out what that looks like. It'll turn your head. So, Angie, before we get into our interview here, what is going on out there in MTA land? Anybody doing anything noteworthy of late?
Oh, of course, of course. We've got lots of people who are taking their running to the next level. We'd like to say congratulations to Academy member Anne Sophie. She's from Denmark. She ran a personal best in the half marathon of 1 hour and 58 minutes.
Nice.
So breaking through that 2 hour barrier, always exciting. Also, congratulations to Rhonda in the Academy. She's from Texas, and she just completed her first 50 miler at the Lean Horse 100 in South Dakota.
Wow, that's amazing.
And this note comes from Rebecca. She says, I recently ran the Sunshine Coast Marathon, and Angie and Trevor ran it with me as I listened to race recaps for almost the whole time. I wasn't feeling great, so I took it easy and just enjoyed the amazing atmosphere, and I had a blast. Thank you so much for the podcast. It got me through some tough moments.
I remember her asking, like, which race recaps people liked the best, because she was getting her playlist together.
That's right.
And then, so I kind of went to our website, and I looked up all of our race recaps, and we've done a ton. We should release a special volume of just race recaps.
Yeah, that would be a good idea.
But anybody want to hear that? I don't know. Some of them are pretty funny, so...
So sometimes I forget about a certain race and then someone will bring it up. They're like, I was thinking about you when I was running this long run, you know, how you were running the New Jersey Marathon in the rain and you were so cold. I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot about that.
Well, you've done a lot of races. Sometimes I'll go to our website and I'll just like go to the race recap tag and like look at them all just to remember where we've been.
It's fun to look at the pictures too.
Yes. The young, naive Angie and Trev.
And this last note comes from Steve. He says, thank you for offering the virtual half marathon experience. I started running 4 years ago, and I've been in love with it from the start. Your podcast has only solidified that love. I'm legally blind, so running is a bit of a challenge sometimes. I can scan my surroundings pretty quickly, but don't always catch everything. I've run a few half marathons in Cleveland with a finishing time of 3 hours, and my new goal is a 2-hour and 30-minute PR. Thank you, Angie and Trevor, for everything.
Well, thank you for that nice note, Steve, and for signing up for the virtual half. And we've heard from a few blind runners throughout the years and always inspired to hear how you guys are able to make it happen.
That's right. That's right.
Well, congrats to all of you out there who are overcoming challenges and reaching new milestones in your running. It's always great to hear from you and just see how you spread the joy of running around so we can feel it.
That's right.
We feel it deep in our hearts, Angie. Well, now we're going to get into our conversation with Vibar Cregan-Reed. He's a senior lecturer in English Lit at the University of Kent in the UK, and he's written on running for The Guardian, The Telegraph, and The Literary Review. His new book is called Footnotes, How Running Makes Us Human. So we'll dive into a lot of aspects about how running makes us human. Also, some interesting asides in this conversation, like the notorious history of the treadmill. Apparently, Oscar Wilde wrote about it, so Vibar is a professor of English Lit, so he's definitely up on any references to running in literature, so, and we asked him about that too, which is fun. Vibar is an academic, and his writing draws from scientific studies, literature, history, and his own running, and the book can be, I don't know how you say it, Angie, it's not really a fast read, it can be pretty deep.
Very rich, full of detail. I mean, I learned so much reading it. It really put into words a lot of the things that I've felt before when I'm out for a run, particularly about enjoying nature and green space. It was a real delight to read. But yeah, it was not a book that you whiz through at all because it's really a deep dive.
Yeah. And I was a little bit worried the interview would be kind of dry. But he was so fun to talk to. Just such a delightful guy. He likes to play video games. He's got a great sense of humor.
Yeah, and his love of running just really comes through. So I think you're really going to enjoy this interview.
All right. So let's go ahead and get in our conversation with Vibar Cregan-Reed right now. Well on my way, well on my way. Okay, we're on the podcast now with Vibar Cregan-Reed, who's joining us from South London. He's the author of the book Footnotes, How Running Makes Us Human. Vibar, good to have you on the show.
Hi, thanks very much for having me on.
We have a copy, I guess the American version of the book. First question I want to ask, what's the difference between an American version and an English version? You know, we've interviewed other authors, and there's a release here in the States, and there's a release in the UK, and I was like, well, what about our brains can we not get from the... UK version.
They have to dumb it down for us.
Yeah, that's what I'm guessing.
Oh, dear. I've got to tread carefully now. No, there's no difference. There's no difference at all. You have the Americans have a slightly cleaner script because there was a delay. It came out in the UK earlier. So, I mean, I caught a few more typos.
Yeah.
Nice.
But other than that, no, it's the same. It's the same.
So what's your background and what led you to write the book?
Okay, my background is that I'm an academic and I teach English at university. So in the States, I think I'd be called a professor, but I have the best job title. My job title is actually reader.
Nice.
Which in the UK means I'm one down from a professor. And I teach 19th century literature, which, I mean, anyone that's read the book would just go, oh, yeah, of course, because there's a lot of literature in the book. So I'm an academic. I've been teaching at universities for about 15 years. I've been employed at the University of Kent for about 10 years. I wrote, this is my second book. I'm working on my third at the moment. My first book was about a really, really, really old poem.
Gilgamesh, right?
Oh, yeah, you've done your research. Yeah.
No, I've read it cover to cover.
Right.
You're the one. The Epic of Gilgamesh. It was a book that took me a long time, and it was very much a book for academics. And at the end of that, I felt like it was time to write something that I was really, really passionate about and something that I wanted to know a lot more about. So I started playing with the idea of doing something with running and with literature, and that became Footnotes.
I have to say it came together really well. I mean, you can tell that you love running and you were able to work in the history of every area that you're able to visit. And I mean, so many things just.
Yeah, there's so much in there, isn't there?
There is. It's packed, really. So tell our audience how you became a runner in the first place.
The honest answer is I'm not really quite sure. I mean, it's always been in our background. When I was a kid, there was a picture on the wall, and this was my mother's brother, who we didn't really see much. We only saw him a couple of times when I was a kid. But he was a barefoot marathon runner of such talent that he ran both for Ireland. I think he's the only Irish athlete ever to have got a gold medal on the track. So he won a marathon at the European Championships in 1966. He also ran against Bekele in 64 and in 68, but he didn't beat him. So running was always sort of in the background, but because we were urban kids brought up in the south of Manchester, which is right in the middle of the UK, literally if you put a pin in Manchester, you could spin and the UK would just go round and round and round. So we're urban kids brought up in Manchester. So we were very active. We'd go and play in the park, but we didn't do sort of serious running. I remember a sports day in which I ran the mile, and I think I just sort of stupidly believed that because my uncle was a good runner, I would be a good runner, and it was disastrous. It was absolutely disastrous. So that really, I did very badly at school, and I got no, they're called GCSEs here, but I didn't go to college or anything. I just went and worked for McDonald's and did sort of the jobs that people do when they have no qualifications, really. And then at 26, I went back to study, and to mine and to everyone else's surprise, I discovered that I was quite good at it.
Wow.
And then when I was writing my PhD thesis, I suddenly realized that I was getting up in the morning, going straight to my desk, working at my desk hours and hours. And then in the evening, I'd sit down and watch movies or go to the cinema. And I just realized all I was doing all the time was just sitting. Mm-hmm. So I started trying to run. And for the first time ever in my life, it stuck. Even though I got into a cycle of injury that I think many runners are very, very familiar with, I just kept going back and back and back and back and back. And that's how I ended up writing a book about it.
Here's just a basic question, but you know, the title of the book, the subtitle, I guess, is How Running Makes Us Human. So the question is, how does it make us human?
The subtitle was actually my publisher's idea. So Footnotes was, I had two titles. I had Psychogeography, which is, yeah, it's a terrible title.
Yeah.
I had Psychogeography.
That is terrible. that's the title of your blog, right?
Yeah, it is. Okay. But I think it's all right to be a bit snooty in your blog.
Oh, yeah.
And the other one was Footnotes, you know, for the obvious reason that it's about, you know, music of the feet, but it's also because I'm an academic and the book has, actually, I don't know, I'm not going to check, but it probably has about 40 pages of footnotes. I remember there was one footnote in there that's about 600 words long.
Yes.
Which took me about a day to do because it was finding all of the references for this environmental psychology. How Running Makes Us Human. So I really, really struggled with the subtitle. My subtitles, like my name, just seemed to go on and on and on and on and on. And then my publisher said, what about How Running Makes Us Human? And I just said, ah, I love it. And it was only when the book came out that I went back to refamiliarize myself with some of the ideas. And then I saw the title of Dan Lieberman's original research from 2006 about parts of our bodies that seem to be geared towards running.
Yeah.
And it was called How Running Made Us Human. And it was just like,
oh.
I feel like I need to send him an apology at some point, but it was completely accidental. The idea is that the book is about all of the ways in which our bodies are geared and wired to be rewarded for movement in really, really complex and what I think is very, very interesting ways. But, you know, the biomechanical reasons are the things that people like Chris McDougall, but mainly Dan Lieberman talked about, like the Achilles tendon, but even like having flat faces. There's a ridge that many animals have that gives them a really, really strong jaw. Mm-hmm. And unlike most primates, we don't have that. We have a mouth that's shoved way back into our skull. And it's also that it allows for a better center of gravity when we're stood upright. But there's stuff all over the body, like the width of the discs in our spine, the relative size of our knee joints, all kinds of things that are specifically designed for this kind of movement as opposed to walking.
So I think runners think about their feet more than other people probably. And really one of the most fascinating parts of the book is that you talk about, you know, how the human foot is, you know, such an amazing part of the body. Talk a little bit about some of the natural technology that's contained in our feet.
Well, I think one of the most amazing things for me, I mean, I knew about this when I was writing footnotes, but I only actually put the parallel together after the book had gone to press, was that in the processing of visual information, about a third of our brain is given over to the processing of visual information. And you have about 200,000 color receptors in each eye. And if you think about the amount of work that we're able to do with that amount of data, it's absolutely astonishing. But we have exactly the same amount of subcutaneous receptors in our feet. So beneath the surface of the skin and the foot, there are about 200,000 receptors on each foot. And they do all sorts of things. They don't just detect touch. They detect heat. They detect cold. They detect pressure. They help us to balance. It's an incredible, I mean, a really, really incredible piece of technology. I went to interview. So I interviewed Dan Lieberman for the book. He kindly gave me his time. But there was also, there's another running and biomechanics expert, a wonderful woman called Professor Irene Davies. And when I was interviewing her, I can't do the whole bit, but it was something along the lines of, you know, 27 bones, 33 articulations, 4 layers of arch muscles, a rigid lever that can be supple and also firm and can propel us. She said, and we wrap all of this up in a shoe? So she was great at really opening my eyes about the just amazing capabilities of what our feet do. They are incredible pieces of technology. And we wrap them up in these great big spongy shoes that are the sensory equivalent of shoving our ears full of cotton wool to keep the world out and at a distance.
And a lot of people's feet probably never see the light of day, really, because if you're not running in shoes, then you're at work in shoes. And, you know, some people wear shoes around the house. And so the foot, you know, becomes a whole different look than what it was designed to. I was in Papua New Guinea for a while, and the natives' feet, they did not look like, you know, our skinny, white, narrow feet.
How did they? Oh, they were much wider.
They're much wider. They look more like hands, to be honest. And they could grip and they could climb and they were very versatile. Just the toes were spread apart so wide, you know, and they could navigate over anything. It was just amazing.
Do you know the reason that the toes spread, Angie?
Well, because they probably have never worn shoes.
Well, I mean, it is that, but there's we have intrinsic muscles. So just like we have, you know, biceps, we have loads of intrinsic muscles. So I think there's 27 in each foot. And Irene Davis used a wonderful analogy of, you know, imagine wearing a neck brace to support your neck. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you were injured and you wore this neck brace, but after you were well, you thought, actually, no, it's, you know, it makes sense. We don't want to injure our necks in modern life. I'm going to keep this on. What would eventually happen is the muscles that support our head would atrophy. They would adapt themselves to the work that they had to do. Our bodies are really lazy, but they're also really, really good at not keeping anything it doesn't need. Hmm. So our bone density constantly changes. So if you are if you do a marathon, your bone density will have gone up significantly. And as soon as you stop, within a matter of a couple of weeks, if you're not doing the same training, the osteoblasts in your bones will start breaking down the bone density because it means you're carrying around weight that your body knows you don't need. So it starts stripping it out. The same goes for muscles. We all know that if you don't use it, then you lose it. Your body doesn't want to have to take in, it doesn't want the burden of taking in the extra calories to maintain something that just is not necessary. So go back to the neck brace. As soon as the neck's supported, the muscles around the neck and around the shoulders are no longer required to do the work they do. So finally, when you do take off the neck brace, you know,
spindly.
Yeah. And shoes that support our arches, that change the way that we move, are doing exactly the same thing to our feet. So we have these lovely, narrow Western feet because the muscles inside the foot have atrophied because the work that the foot is normally required to do is being outsourced to the shoe. So the people that you saw in Papua New Guinea had muscular feet, and muscular feet mean the toes spread apart. You should be able to get sort of pen or a finger between your big toe and your next toe if you've got a muscular foot. But we can get this strength back. It just takes a bit of time.
This is fascinating stuff. So any other way that running makes us human that we could talk about, you think it'd be valuable for listeners, sort of as a takeaway from the book?
One of the main things I'd say would be the psychological aspects, the ways in which our brain is wired to be rewarded by certain kinds of experience. And it seems to me that there are two. But to say that there are only two is ridiculous because there are many, 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 many. So the first is that exercise balances things like the neurotransmitters in our brain. It's much better at balancing norepinephrine, serotonin and dopamine than any antidepressant is. So anybody that's stressed or struggles with self-esteem, a run or any kind of intensive exercise will reward them with a more settled environment for their neurotransmitters. Running also makes us more intelligent. I mean, I think there's a really strong evolutionary argument for why this is. But in our hippocampus, which is the part of our brain, sort of like a horseshoe shape at the back there, in our hippocampus, certain kinds of exercise will basically ping brain cells, create brain cells. It's a process called neurogenesis, where the new brain cells mean that you don't suddenly become smart. You don't suddenly become Einstein. But what will happen is that you will have the equivalent of a blank pad and a sharpened pencil. So if you want to learn something, you have literally new brain cells that are waiting to be put to use.
Nice. So you're saying that sort of to prime your brain to learn something new, you could exercise or go on a run to do that.
Yeah. So I'm not a morning. I'm usually a sort of mid-morning to mid-afternoon. I run somewhere in that window because I'm an early morning writer and it's when I think best. So I usually try and do that first. But early morning runners, if they go out before work, that's when they'll be at their best. If you were learning a language or something, I'd love for someone to do a trial on this about language learning. I'm convinced that there would be a strong link between the ability to uptake completely new information after exercise.
I should try that.
Trevor's trying to learn German right now, so maybe he should schedule his run and then his German studies right after that.
It wouldn't be a bad idea. I mean, not a kind of completely exhausting run, but it wouldn't be a bad idea. And there's loads of other things. Like there's a substance called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, that's a protein that's basically like John Ratey, Harvard neuroscientist, said it's basically like a miracle grow for the brain. It means that the dendrites, the roots of our brain cells, are able to grow more effectively, and that also means that they're able to make more connections across the synapses as well. So it's just a sort of perfect form of exercise in terms of our mental well-being. And there's loads of others, like what being out in a green space does for us, which is just sort of like a Harry Potter magic wand of good stuff as well.
I'm glad you brought that up, because we had a question about the green space idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I appreciate nature and even the seasons so much more as a runner. So talk about the concept of what green exercise means.
So there's actually there's a research group at the University of Essex called the Green Exercise Research Group. And what they do there is they look at the physiological and psychological benefits of exercise. So everyone knows that exercise is good for us. But they then specifically focus on the ways in which the two come together. So how exposure to green environments builds on that sort of exercise experience. And it's coming out of research that really started, I suppose it started in the United States about 40 years ago with some people called the Kaplans at the University of Michigan. So environmental psychology has got a very simple remit. What it tries to do is it tries to look at the ways in which environments impact upon us. So trials have been done on everything from having plants on your desk in your workplace and measuring relative productivity, or people being able to see green spaces out of their windows and how that affects crime rates in an area. There's a really fantastic study done on crime rates and green spaces in Chicago, I think it was. So environmental psychology is this huge discipline that's interested in all kinds of things. But the basic idea is that our brain, you know, is like a muscle. So if we lift something very light, like my book, if we lift something very, very light, that's very, very easy to lift. We can carry on doing that for, you know, half an hour, maybe 60 minutes. After about 60 minutes, it would start to get a bit tiring and you'd think, oh, maybe, okay, this is getting a bit more light work. And then after 2 hours, it would become a real struggle. So our abilities to concentrate are very similar. If we start fresh on something that we're working on, what happens is our ability to focus stays constant, and then it starts to fall away. And usually when people get mentally tired, it's a feeling that we all recognize. What we then try to do is go to do our favorite things to recharge. Watching TV, some people like to read a book. Some people like to video game. That's not a verb, is it? Never mind.
It is now.
It could be.
I love gaming. But all of these things also require further attentional capacity. So instead of restoring us, they are actually draining us even further, so that when we go to bed after a few hours of TV, we are completely exhausted. I talk about some of the trials in the book, but basically the short answer, this is already a very long answer, sorry. Short answer is that the fastest way to restore that muscle, to restore that ability to concentrate, is to have some exposure to a green space. And even a simulacrum of a green space, like watching a green space on a TV or something, still has a restorative effect. But that kind of soft fascination that forces us to look away from the problem that we're dealing with and just look at a tree or something is what restores us most quickly. Once you put things like that together with exercise, you've got a kind of perfect storm of physical and mental restoration.
I feel a different sense of, you know, when I go on a run outside versus when I run on the treadmill. Treadmill runs, I kind of feel more drained mentally, and it just doesn't give me that, I don't know, it doesn't do the same thing for my brain. And you have a really interesting chapter in the book about the treadmill. So tell us a little bit how the treadmill came to be.
I don't know. I mean, I thought I was fair to treadmills in the book, because I do use them. You know, like everybody, I use treadmills. But I was sure that something was up with the treadmill. I came in from a run one day, and I always feel like I'm dragging ideas behind me when I come in from a run. And sometimes they're terrible, and sometimes they're quite good. anyway, this one day I came in from the run and I was sure, I just thought, yeah, Oscar Wilde and treadmills, I'm sure there's something here. So I wrote a little blog and then the blog grew and grew and grew and ended up becoming the, I think it was the first chapter of the book that I wrote actually. But what I discovered was that treadmills were invented because of the death penalty. There was a whole sort of cultural, there was a whole environment in which in the 18th century where everything was up for grabs during the Enlightenment. People were rethinking politics. You know, there were revolutions all over the world. You know, you had one, there's quite a big one in the States. they were everywhere. So everything was up for grabs. And one of the things was that people started rethinking the way that people were punished for crimes. So it made no sense, for example, to have a death penalty for stealing a loaf of bread, which was very common. Because if the person steals a loaf of bread and somebody sees them and gives chase, they get the same punishment if they kill five people trying to evade capture as they did for stealing the loaf of bread. So what they wanted was a more measured penal system. So they thought of different kinds of punishments other than exploitation and the death penalty. There had to be some stuff in between. So the idea of hard labor was invented, and they thought a lot about hard labor. They thought it should be work that's hard, but the other thing was that it should be work that's completely useless, that it doesn't do something that's useful for society, because the prisoner should be punished for the work that they shouldn't get value or self-esteem from the work they're doing. It should be absolutely pointless toil. And you know where this is going.
Perfect setup, man.
An engineer from Norfolk, I think it was, a guy called William Cubitt, came up with the idea of the treadmill. So initially it started off looking a bit more like a Stairmaster, actually, on a giant wheel. And instead of people being put to death or given the death penalty, they'd be sentenced to hard labour, and they would work this wheel, usually for 2 to 3 hours. But when Oscar Wilde went to prison in 1895, I think it was, and he was unlucky because he went just after there'd been a set of reforms that meant that people worked the mill for up to about 6 hours a day.
Wow.
And then when he came out of prison, he lasted about another 2 years. He was completely destroyed by his time in prison. He lasted about another 2 years, and then he died in 1900 or 1901. So, my God, you know, so it's this terrible instrument of torture. It's mentioned in Dickens's Christmas Carol a couple of times. It's mentioned in lots of 19th century novels. And then it disappears from the penal system, I think, just before the Great War, the First World War. And then it's like one of the best rebrands in the history of the world. a couple of decades later, it emerges out of the University of Washington as this sort of as a machine that a scientist was using to assess people that he thought may or may not have heart problems. And then, boom, it just took off. And now, you know, I think you're never more than 100 yards from a treadmill. If you live in an urban environment, you're never more than 100 yards from a treadmill.
Even if it's just being used to hang your clothes over.
I didn't know that the treadmill was mentioned in Dickens. And did Oscar Wilde write about it too?
Yeah, he did. It's in a poem that he wrote, but he only wrote it after he'd been to prison.
Yeah,
obviously. The Ballad of Reading Gaol. But yeah, it's mentioned in, I think it's in quite a few Dickens' novels. It's in some Anthony Trollope novels. And it's in another 19th century novelist who was very big here in the mid-19th century, Elizabeth Gaskell. Everybody knew about the treadmill. Do you remember the bit in The Muppet Christmas Carol when Beaker and the professor go in and try to get Michael Caine to sign up to a charity subscription? The bit when... Oh, I'm a bigger fan of Muppet Christmas Carol than you are, I think.
No, I've seen the movie. I just got to try to bring it up. Muppet Treasure Island was my favorite. So.
right. Okay. Christmas Carol for me. Well, it's at that moment when he says, you know, what's going on? Have all the treadmills broken? You know, why do we have to pay for these people?
So I'm curious to see how else the world of English literature and the world of running can kind of mingle together. And that's what was fascinating about the book, and something that I don't think about that often. So maybe you could share some more little anecdotes like that.
Okay, yeah, I work on Victorian literature, on 19th century literature, and my first book took me a really, really, really long time to write. I think because I didn't really want to write it. I knew that I had to write it, so I kept going and kept going, and on and off, it took me about 7 years. Mm. This one came much more quickly. So I had the idea of it for about 2 years, and it was being kicked about between my agent and between publisher. And when people heard, so when my colleagues asked me, or when I'd go to a conference and people would say, what are you working on? I'd say, a book about running. And they'd go, all right.
Blank look.
Then they'd start, you could see that their Rolodex was going, trying to think of, so are there any characters in Thomas Hardy that run? No, there are. And they'd usually start telling me about some character in a novel that had to run somewhere for something. And it was like, no, that's not really what I'm mm-hmm. working on. So it was difficult because I think what I'm interested in is jogging, although I don't like that word, but I am a jogger and I'm writing about jogging. I'm writing about the sorts of normal running that people do every day mm-hmm. rather than, you know, 150-mile races through the Sahara or something. So I often found it quite difficult to make the connection between the two things. So there was a few cases like Oscar Wilde and the treadmill where it was very, very easy and there was a very strong historical connection between the two. But then I started to see that many of the things that I felt were that running was about for me, about engagement with the environment, about rethinking not only my place, about who I am in my own life, but who we are as a species. And also, you know, thinking about environmental issues as well. And then I just started thinking, actually, all of these things, these are all debates that are in 19th century literature. So although there are no, I think this is true, there are no runners in 19th century fiction. There's the odd one here and there, like Wilkie Collins's Man and Wife has a very sort of athletic man in it. But on the whole, there are no joggers because people didn't need to. People had jobs.
Hardworking jobs, physical jobs.
Okay, wait, this might be totally off. I might be off here, but who wrote The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner?
That was Alan Sillitoe, and it was about 1967.
Okay.
It's a very long short story. It's really, really good.
Okay. All I knew was the Iron Maiden song by the same title.
There was one. Is there an Iron Maiden song about the loneliness?
Yeah, by the same title, yeah. Yeah, and I think it goes into the book, the story, which I've never read. So,
the lead singer of Iron Maiden, he's a historian, isn't he?
I wouldn't be surprised.
He is. Bruce Dickinson, and he went to Oxford, I think.
Wow, that's why I like the band so much.
On the whole, the literature of running is not broad. There isn't a great deal of it. So there is the Alan Sillitoe. And there are a few novels now, like Once a Runner and things like that. But it's not easy to find stories about running because running is, it seems to me, is not really about stories. It's about reflection.
Yeah.
And it's sort of free-flowing. It's more like literary modernism, really. You know, in the 19th century, people had jobs. And even though that people were no longer working on much fewer people were working on the land, the other kinds of jobs that they had were still really, really hard, intensive labor. Working in factories was still very hard work. There's some recent research just come out of Harvard about levels of knee osteoarthritis. I don't know if you've read about this. Mm-hmm. They've done this, I've just been writing about it for my new book. They've done this test where they've looked at the rates of knee osteoarthritis in humans estimated 50 years or older from now all the way back to 6,000 years ago.
Wow.
And they found that the prevalence of osteoarthritis, even in Neanderthal species as well, of osteoarthritis in people estimated 50 years or older, 6,000 years ago, it was about 8%. During the Industrial Revolution, it dropped to 6% because presumably people were on their feet the whole time working in the mills. And then after the Second World War, it jumps suddenly to 18%.
Wow.
In the history of our species, to have a sudden appearance of symptoms like that is really quite astonishing.
I wonder what it'll be in the next 50 years if we continue at, you know, our sedentary mm-hmm. pace of life, that if it'll continue to jump, kind of a scary thought.
Yeah, it will. In fact, I think that we're living in a blip of sedentariness. And I think the message is going to start getting out about the kinds of damage that a sedentary life does even to fit people. So, you know, if you go to the gym for an hour, but you sit down at your office and you sit down to commute home and then you sit down when you're at home, you're still effectively living a sedentary life,
right,
even though your heart health might be slightly better. Have you noticed I'm standing up?
Yeah, exactly.
I did notice that. I was about to say, it's got to be hard as an academic where you're having to do a lot of reading and studying. And I know when I was in college, I sure did a lot of sitting. So right. How do you, maybe you can give us some hacks on, you know, how you optimize your environment to not sit so much and be more healthy.
My next book is going to be about how our bodies have been changed by modern life, all the ways in which our bodies have been changed by modern life, different body parts and how they've either taken on a different use or in most cases, they've lost their original use. So I'm doing things like the feet and the knees and the face and, you know, especially our jaws. And for the second chapter was about our glutes, about our muscles in our butts. And up until that point, I regularly sat down. So I was writing this about 6 weeks ago. I started researching it and the research was so alarming that I've now got a converted sort of table that goes up and down like an office chair that I have my computer on. But actually, since it's gone into my study, it's never been back down.
Awesome.
So I stand up all the time and I now walk a lot and my treadmill use has changed. So I don't run on treadmills, but I usually write in the morning. Then whatever book I need to be reading, I listen to as I walk about 2 miles to the gym. And then at the gym, I'll have research loaded up on my iPad that I have to read, and I will walk on the treadmill while I read it. So I have to highlight things that's like this. The highlight is all messed up because of that. And then I'll go downstairs in the gym and maybe write a little bit more. And then when I've got something else to read, I'll go back up and walk a little more. So it just means that I'm covering about sort of 7 miles on foot every day. And then at the end of the day, I get to sit down and it's completely guilt-free.
Exactly.
Nice.
Because I've been on my feet all day. And, you know, if I sit down for 3 hours a day, I'm fine with that. But before I was sitting down for about 9. So, So the main thing is the desk that will allow you to stand and to sit. Also resting in a squat, which I could demonstrate, but I could just do that.
Disappear.
So yeah, I just did it.
Awesome.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Vaibhar. It's a great book. We recommend everybody go out and get Footnotes, How Running Makes Us Human. And by the way, now that you've teased it, we're looking forward to the next book coming out.
At the moment, it's called Primate Change.
Oh, nice.
Primate Change, is that what you said?
It's like climate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's about how our bodies have changed because of the environment around us. So Primate Change. But that might change. Thank you very, very much for having me on. It's been a great pleasure.
All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview. Thank you, Vaibhar, for being on the MTA podcast and taking time to talk with us. Folks, definitely check out the book Footnotes, How Running Makes Us Human. We'll have a link to it over on our website with the show notes to this episode. This is episode 223. Before we get into this episode's quick tip about staying healthy during marathon training season, I'd like to thank our episode sponsor, Thrive Market. Thrive Market's been a great sponsor for the podcast. We appreciate them. They sell all the top organic and healthy products at 25 to 50% off and ship it straight to your door. You can find thousands of specialty products, and again, they sell it at wholesale costs.
Thrive Market also makes it super easy to shop. Not only is it all online and it ships straight to your door, but every single product on their site is tagged by over 90 different values. So with one click, you can sort the entire catalog by things like non-GMO, organic, vegan, gluten-free, paleo, sustainably farmed, whatever your preferred method of eating is.
So we've been getting some stuff through Thrive Market, and Angie, you've been wicked lately.
Particularly the Taza Organic Wicked Dark Ground Chocolate Bar. This thing is 95% chocolate. It is completely rich and one little square totally takes care of any chocolate cravings. And the amazing thing is that the price on Thrive Market is the lowest I've ever seen it. You know, I like to try different types of chocolate bars, especially anything above 85% dark chocolate type of bars. And so I was really excited to see this one. I mean, it's like 50% off where I could find it anywhere else.
So yeah, it's cool when you can find just really killer prices on healthy food. And when a company is willing to offer free shipping and other discounts, that's just the cherry on top. So you can get 20% off your first three purchases. That's $60 worth of value plus free shipping when you use the link thrivemarket.com/MTA. Really simple, thrivemarket.com/MTA. And they're also going to do a drawing for a $50 starter kit with lots of goodies. And all you got to do is enter your email to be entered in that drawing. We'll choose a winner at the end of 30 days. So to check it out, just go to thrivemarket.com/MTA. Well, now it's time for this episode's quick tip, when we want to talk about an important subject, and that is staying healthy during marathon training. Because if your immune system goes down, that can cause you to miss some very important training runs.
Yeah, that's right. This quick tip was actually prompted by Molly, who posted in the Academy Facebook group. And she says, I always get sick after marathons. What does everyone use to stay healthy? And I thought that was such a great question, because as we go into the month of September, September is, you know, one of the top marathon months. So people have been training hard, you know, all through the summer. As we go into September and October, a lot of people are going to be doing their races, and none of us want to spend time down with a sickness.
Right. And Angie, you are a nurse, a registered nurse, so you're always full of healthy tips.
Well, research has shown that after running a marathon, there's a shift in immune system function for approximately 72 hours, where you're more susceptible to things like upper respiratory infections. But even a heavy training cycle can sometimes lead to immune system suppression. So it's important to be supporting your body along the way. So in your training and after the race.
So after you run a race, jump on a plane to get back home. What could go wrong?
A bunch of germy people. Exactly. Yeah, and my first tip is hand washing. Since most germs are spread through contact with surfaces, which then get transferred to our mucous membranes, eyes, nose, mouth, that is a big source of germ transmission. So make sure you wash your hands frequently. Anytime you're riding on an airplane, you just don't know how frequently surfaces get disinfected on there. Kind of scary when you think about it. And this is another thing that I didn't really think about that someone mentioned in our group, is that limiting contact with other runners post-race, things like hugs, high fives, kisses, may transmit germs too. So celebrate for sure, but make sure you wash your hands if you're having a lot of contact with other people.
I don't think anybody wants to kiss me right after I finish a marathon. I'm pretty...
it's pretty rough.
Pretty grimy. I have like salt caked to my face.
Yeah.
Lips are all cracked. Nose is running. Do you feel like kissing me after I finish a marathon, honey?
You're always collapsed on the ground, so I don't want to bend down to kiss you.
Yeah. Okay, tip number two.
This is to keep your stress level as low as possible. Chronic stress raises the body's cortisol levels, which can increase inflammation in your body and often lead to sickness. So taking steps to manage your stress by training smart, working on healthy relationships, getting enough sleep, making time for relaxation, and regular meditation will really help decrease your stress level.
Easier said than done, though, huh? Because sometimes just life can be stressful, and some things are outside of your control, and what can you do?
That's right. That's why I think it's important to be intentional about keeping your stress level as low as possible, because we can't control the things that happen to us. And some situations, whether it be work or relationships or kids, you know, there's a number of things that can lead to a stressful lifestyle. But I think we have to be really intentional about getting that sleep, you know, making time to relax and have fun, and making time to meditate too, or have some quiet time where you can reflect.
Yeah, make some time for yourself, kind of as a way to just step back and do some self-care before you jump back into the fray. It's important.
Exactly, because no one's going to make you do these kind of things. You really have to do them for yourself. The third tip is to reduce your sugar intake. Eating sugary foods and drinks suppresses your immune system for at least 2 hours after consumption. So if you're regularly consuming high amounts of sugar, that's going to keep your immune system suppressed, making you more vulnerable to various infections. The next thing would be to increase your healthy food intake. So looking at your diet, you want to eat healthy whole foods that contain an array of vitamins, minerals, and antioxidants, things like cherries, berries, grapes, nuts, dark leafy greens, sweet potatoes, carrots, green tea, and of course my personal favorite, dark chocolate, are all very healthy to the body. Of course, drink plenty of water, and many runners find that probiotics are helpful, or eating fermented foods, which have probiotics in them naturally.
Lots of sauerkraut.
That's right.
That's why I'm going to Germany.
For the sauerkraut, right.
Yes.
It's not the beer.
For all the healthy food.
For the sausages.
Beer and sausages and chocolate. Chocolada.
That's your story and you're sticking to it, huh? And the fifth thing is to consider herbs or supplements. Now, the jury's still out on whether a lot of these herbs and supplements are truly effective, so you have to test them out for yourself. I think we can't say 100% that all these things are effective, but many other people have reported they've helped. So things like garlic, turmeric, ginger, echinacea. I like to use Young Living essential oil called Thieves. It's a proprietary blend that has antimicrobial abilities. It contains clove, lemon, cinnamon, eucalyptus, and rosemary. So try some different things and see what works for your body. The sixth tip is to get more sleep. Most of us don't get the recommended 7 to 9 hours of sleep each night. And even if you're managing on less sleep, this still has a detrimental long-term effect on our health and training. So I know I get on this soapbox a lot, but really the importance of sleep cannot be overemphasized.
You know, especially in the taper up to the marathon, that's like almost as important as any workouts on the plan, don't you think?
Yeah, the recovery is such a big aspect. And I think many people, because of nerves, train too hard, maybe don't get enough sleep, keep themselves, you know, kind of stay agitated in those days leading up to the race.
Right.
And, you know, that can really be stressful to the body.
That's why I like starting times at 11 o'clock and 12 o'clock. Our Spartan race wave that my buddy and I did didn't start till 12:30.
Wow.
So
yeah. I'd be ready for a nap by then. I think our circadian rhythms are a little bit different. And the final tip is to not overtrain. One reason runners get sick is often they have too many high-intensity workout days without enough built-in easy and recovery days. It's really unrealistic to do intense workouts 6 days per week and still expect your body to perform at its best.
Yeah.
Something's going to give if you don't build in recovery and easy workouts.
There's definitely a science to it. And overtraining, from what we've found, the number one cause why people don't do well in the marathon, maybe get injured and can't run it or just really have a tough time of it.
Yeah, that's right. It's something that's very insidious. It kind of sneaks up on you. And one minute you think you're fine and that you're unable to handle the heavy load. And the next minute your body's kind of dug itself into a hole. And so you got to be really proactive about things like sleep and recovery and good nutrition, which is why we talk about it a lot on the podcast, because these have to be things that are important to you and that you implement because you're looking at the big picture.
So, Angie, do you think it's sometimes normal to be a little bit sick after a marathon because, you know, you just put your body through something very strenuous? Maybe your immune system is a little bit weak.
Yeah, certainly your body is more vulnerable in those 72 hours after a race. So that's the time really to, you know, refuel well, to rehydrate, to, you know, keep moving around and do a little bit of easy stretching, get your sleep and start really eating some healthy foods.
Yeah, you can do like what my friend and I did after the Spartan race, eat Mexican food, drink a lot of beer, and go climb a 14er.
That might work too. The key is to find out what works for your body and stick with it. So if you feel good doing it, then keep it up.
Yeah, definitely. The goal is to be healthy and strong for the next time and to think about your running with the big picture in mind. We want you to be a healthy, active person late into life.
That's right.
Well, that's it for this episode. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast in iTunes if you haven't done that. And you can also find us on other platforms like Google Play. And we'd love to connect with you on the socials. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And of course, you can find notes to various links and things that were mentioned over on our website, marathontrainingacademy.com. If you've never visited our website, you should go check it out. It's a beautiful website.
Says the designer.
And by the way, if you're going to be at the Munich Marathon in Munich, Germany this year, drop me an email. I'll be there. I'd love to see what kind of meetup we can get together. Just email me at trevor@marathontrainingacademy.com. Thanks again, folks. Just want to encourage you to keep running. And remember, you have what it takes to conquer the marathon and change your life. Right on my way.